and welcome everyone to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is implementing role-based access control and enabling audit trail support using WebSphere Data Interchange version 3.3 client. Today's presenter is John Kirkwood. John is a senior software engineer providing technical customer support for WebSphere Data Interchange. He has assisted hundreds of customers worldwide with installing and implementing WebSphere Data Interchange. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to John.
All right. Thank you, David. Now, welcome, everyone. Move on to slide two. We'll get to the agenda. I want to take this time to go over a couple features of WDI, for which I've had several queries about as of late. It's a couple of features that I do not see getting used probably as much as I would think customers would want to use. Now, and I'll start with an overview of the WDI, in other words, WebSphere Data Interchange client. That's a Windows-based client, and the security options that are available within this client. I'll also cover some of the DB2 aspects of this as well. I'll review the role-based access control feature, including permissions and user IDs. I'll briefly cover access groups, which takes it a step further. And then I'll cover an example of a role-based solution. I think you'll find this example pretty useful. It helps get you started, and then you can expand on this if you need to tighten it further or you need to really use the role-based solution in a more robust manner. Then I'm going to change gears and talk about the audit trail feature to track changed objects, in other words, to help you with your change control. Move on to slide three. Let's talk about the overview of the client security available in WDI Client 3.3. It's composed of basically two components. There's a role-based access control component, which is probably the more popular or the most useful part of the product in terms of security control. It's intended to limit, the object types or functions that a user can perform on any given object type. And it's a way to assign groups of users to a particular role, such as an administrator or a mapper or, what have you from a WDI functionality standpoint. And then there's access groups. This could further limit which objects a user can see within an object type. In other words, the difference being that you could control a group of maps by user. In other words, you can have some maps that are associated with one group of users, other maps that are associated with another group of users. So it's basically just expands on, this concept of role-based access control. You can use either role-based access control or access groups, with or without the other. Or they can be used together. The user ID definitions that you put into the WDI Windows client is how it's controlled. This only pertains to the client access. In other words, the server access is something different. It is controlled strictly by DB2, and it doesn't override the underlying DB2 authorizations. Currently, if you're using WDI client, you had been giving access to tables, views, etc., and that continues to be protected by these grant statements, or lack thereof. If you don't have grants on particular tables, the user, even if they're given access through this role-based access control or what have you, it's not going to override the DB2 permissions that are assigned. Go to slide four. We'll continue with the overview. Now, the WDI server aspect does not participate in the WDI client security. That's for the most part. There are, some exceptions, like for perform import or delete, you know, that could affect the system settings or the security settings, which that does participate. You know, again, the server being where you run the actual translations, et cetera. You know, again, WDI client is used to administer the product, to set up the product, to customize maps, et cetera, whereas the server is actually what's running, you know, the tasks that are doing the translation. WDI access to the underlying tables. We do provide DB2 data definition language. It's also called DDL. This provides the traditional DB2 grant, execute on plan, you know, and realize it's the plan access, not the specific table access, which actually controls the server. In other words, when the server runs in batch, CICS, Windows server, or AIX server, you know, it's going to be, the permissions are going to be granted based on the execute on the plan privilege. And we do provide the DDL, you know, to provide the grant for the plan, which is, that's a real easy thing to do. I mean, you've already probably done that, but this, the DDL that's provided in the link is geared towards when you do implement role-based access, it will, you know, you can use these particular downloads to give the permissions or the grants to the particular role. Like, for example, one, you know, a mapper might have just access to the mapping tables and views, you know, whereas an administrator might have access to the trading partners and maps. This link does provide you with some full-blown, you know, set of grant statements for all the tables and views pertaining to how the role is set up. And again, a role being just the concept of grouping users together as a role, and because they provide similar tasks, you know, they perform similar tasks. Go on to slide 5. By default, the security in the Windows-based client is disabled. There's two different databases that WDI has. One is the configuration, and the other is the system database. The configuration database is typically a standalone database. That's what I see as the norm from customers. You know, in other words, that just contains your basic settings like the background color, your query list, you know, some very just general type preferences. So that typically is just standalone for most users. And the system database, that's your important database. That's the DB2 side of things. That's what the runtime, you know, the server is going to be accessing. You know, test versus production can be controlled separately. I'm going to focus primarily on the setup of the system databases, as that is the more important database. You can set up a shared configuration database for your system. It would need to be installed in a DB2 environment to do that. I'm not going to cover how to do that here, but just for your awareness, that you know the configuration database theoretically can be shared, you know, among all your users, but that will take a bit of setup to do. The system database is, again, the important one. That's the DB2 runtime environment that you must protect. Now, just realize the configuration database, if it is in a shared environment, you could actually set up security for it as well. Just for your reference, I gave you a link here, that last bullet, about all the publications for WDI. The administration and security guide is the reference in Chapter 2. That's where you'll find documentation on all of this security access. Let's move on to slide 6. So let's move on to the specifics of role-based access control. This is more of a broader swath. In other words, you're not doing a group of maps. This is more for all maps. Like, and you, that's what I mean by an object type. Like trading partners would be a type, maps would be a type, EDI standards would be a type. And what this role-based access control can do is it restricts the types of objects that a user can view. And it also even goes so far as to, you know, disable buttons and menu options and lists that are performed. So it's you know, rather than just giving everybody full, let me just back up. If you were to just keep the role-based access control disabled as it is by default, you know, the underlying DB2 permissions, if not there, will cause the user then to experience, you know, cryptic, I'll call it, you know, DB2 error messages that would, you know, be confusing, et cetera. You know, if they try to access something they're not authorized to, you know, you'll get database errors instead. But what this role-based access is, you're saying what the client will go after. In other words, what are you allowing from the Windows-based client to be able to even attempt to perform? And it also does control functions that a user can perform, like from the document store features. There are some particular activities that you can perform, like translations or retranslations, you know, et cetera. And that also is controlled by this role-based access. It's easy to enable. Now, you don't want to just go willy-nilly and enable this. I do go through an example coming up, so be sure to follow along there before ever enabling this. You can see in that screenshot there, I'll also discuss these other options coming up. One important note, if you see the system security option tab grayed out, you simply just need to connect to the DB by opening anything from the WDI client. Like, for example, open a trading partner or open a map. It's really just anything that prompts you to connect to the DB2 database, the system database, that will then enable that tab. Go to slide 7. Now, it's important that you have the authority to update system objects on your configuration database and on the target system, the DB2 database, in other words, before you can enable the access control. This ensures that you'll be able to turn it off you'll be able to turn off role-based access control if you need to. Go to slide 8. I alluded to earlier, the list windows, you know, once it's enabled and a user is restricted, you know, the list window won't appear for that object type if they're not authorized to view it. So they won't even be able to see the list of trading partners or a list of maps, et cetera, if they're not allowed to. And even actions like menu actions or options will be disabled. Is not authorized to use them. On to slide 9. Getting into some details about the roles that are already defined. You know, as shipped, WDI comes with these particular roles, as you see on that screenshot. There's administrator, configuration, data formats, which is ADF by another term. You know, the document store, EDI administrator, mapper, operations, super user, trading partner administration, XML administrator. These are just some ideas that we've proposed to kind of give you some examples. You don't need to use them just like they are. You can modify these or customize them as you wish. And you can even add your own roles as needed. Let's move on to slide 10. Permissions and user IDs. As part of the enablement of this, you need to define the user IDs for those that will be logging on to the enabled system. They can be assigned to no roles or they can be assigned to many roles, just depending on what their particular job role is. can contain specific permissions for particular objects. This would override those given by role permissions. Again, you don't have to even use roles necessarily. You can just use permissions, but it's very tedious because each user would then need to have explicit permissions. So what the role is doing, it was just grouping similar permissions together so multiple users can be assigned accordingly. One key part of this, too, just to make sure that access groups can be used with role-based access control or not. I mean, you don't have to have the access group features enabled or use that for role-based access control. Importantly, is the user ID definitions must be entered as they appear on the server. It is case sensitive, so if you're like, for example, a ZOS user, the user IDs are always uppercase. When you're adding a user ID to assign to a role, for example, you would need to enter it exactly how it would be on the server. So for ZOS, it's always uppercase. For Windows and AIX servers, they would be obviously, could be mixed case. And it would be important to match the exact definition. Go to slide 11. Continuing with the permissions and user IDs. Now, roles are assigned permissions for each object. In other words, like I said before, it was kind of categorizing all of the particular permissions based on what the particular role is of the user. And then you assign the user ID to a role. And there's an important feature or useful feature to make things easier for you is you can set up a default user called /WDIUser to define general access for users not specifically defined to the system. So that's useful if you have like very specific, if you have a simpler environment where you have a set of users that really needs full access, et cetera, you can give that to them explicitly, which we're going to cover later, and then the default user ID would then be used for any that are not explicitly defined to the client. In other words, you could make the WDI user, default user, that is, with very limited access, maybe view only, and that's what we're going to cover coming up, too. You can nest roles. I mean, you can have role defined, where they're merged, and, the permissions are merged if you're assigned multiple roles. Slide 12. I was saying before, a user ID could be defined to many roles, or just one role, or no roles for that matter, or given specific permissions. And again, I think using a role is a better way to go. Like I said, then each user ID, you don't have to specify all the specific permissions, and there are many of them, by the way. There's a lot of different object types in WDI, as I'm sure you're aware, and I don't think you'd want to be, for each user ID, adding very individual permissions for every object type. I think the example will show you a good demonstration of that. Now, if you do assign a user to a role, you can then specify specific permissions, which would take precedence over that particular role. So they can be used in conjunction. If perhaps you've got, you want a super user, has full access, and then there's another one, well, you want to restrict them just from certain object types, you could use the permissions specifically to do that. And there is a very good feature, the summary button. When you're displaying the user ID, there's a button that will give you a summary of all the permissions they have. So it basically does the algorithm internally, to show you which permissions are all being set based on if you've got multiple roles assigned or if you've got specific permissions also assigned that take precedence. Let's move on to slide 13. talk about the permission levels. There are, it's not just your simple read, update, create, and delete. There are more than that. You have obviously none, which is saying that you can't access the object type that would be used to limit the particular, so the user can't even get into the particular object type and list anything from them. And that's what none would be used for. Read, you'd be able to view the object types. And note that when you specify read on it, it also is presented from the client perspective, to the user in a view mode only. So they wouldn't even be able to type over any of the fields or attempt to, right? And so everything would be kind of grayed, and not alterable. Update, of course, includes read access. I think that's a kind of obvious one. It just allows you to make changes to the particular object that you have up. Create allows you, includes update and allows you to create new objects for the object type. Delete, similarly, but just allows you to delete. The submit, that's probably maybe something you don't know about, but submit is what I was talking about before, where there are some features within the WDI client that allow you to invoke the translator through client remote submission. So this limits, if you're not given submit access, the user would not be able to invoke those features for that particular type, object type. Not specified. The default is read for most types. Okay, let's move on to slide 14. Briefly discuss the access groups. Remember, this is to limit a subset of objects for a given object type. It is optional, as role-based access is a separate component. Enable this via the system editor. I give you the path for the menu options to get to this. It's easy to just click that button and get it started, but realize there is a lot more behind access groups, and that would be in terms of you'd have to, this is something that would take a lot more to implement because you need to assign every object to an access group. And we're not going to cover access groups here specifically. It is a more lengthy type setup, but I wanted to make sure you're aware of it and you may want to start using it. And again, similarly, just that last note at the bottom, again, if you're finding the tab is grayed out when you go to the security options tab, if it's grayed out or you can't connect, click on that tab heading, you've got to connect to the database first. And you just open anything, like present a list of maps, open a trading partner, anything that causes DB2 Connect, for example, to go off and connect to the database, then those options will be enabled. I'm sorry, that tab, the security objects tab, will be enabled. Go on to slide 15. Now, an object that's supporting access groups can be assigned to one access group only. And if you don't assign a particular object to an access group, it will automatically be assigned to the global group. Any given user ID can participate in multiple access groups. By default, all users can access all groups. User IDs that have no access group will not be restricted by an access group. Not available for the configuration database, either shared or standalone. Access groups, in other words, only pertains to the DB2 system database side of things. On to slide 16. Now, I'll now cover an example of a role-based solution. Even though there are several security scenarios provided in the Administration and Security Guide in the appendix, I'm going to go through a quick and effective scenario that is not covered in this appendix. And again, this comes from some experience that I've had with several customers. And this seems to be, this example is almost more enforced or in use, than the more complicated examples that you'll see in these in the appendix as covered. In other words, I think once you get through this presentation, and there's also a tech note on the setup which gives a little more detail than this presentation does, that does go through the particular scenario we're going to cover now. And again, this is just a real nice and effective scenario that can get you out of the problem of, right now everybody's got access and I've got to try to restrict, what users are doing. And this is one very effective way to do it. We'll go through the scenario here on slide 17. The question that comes in is, how do I enable client role-based access whereby I have one set of administrators who need full access to everything and all other users have read-only access? So in other words, everybody else can only view all of the objects in WDI. Now, this requirement can be satisfied by adding specific administrator user IDs. So, you explicitly add these user IDs, and they're given the highest permission. And then the default ampersand WDI user ID then accommodates all other read-only users. Again, while this seems simple, it is the type of control that I'm hearing about from users. And it's nice and it's easy and effective, and it would really get you started from, getting comfortable with it. There are a lot of features behind these particular functions, the roles and the access groups. So, this will just give you a good starting point. And also, I think, depending on how many users you have and if you really have all these defined roles and different groups of users, you're going to definitely need to expand on this. This should get you started. Let's go to slide 18 and go through some of the steps. If it's already enabled, before you go through any of this, you need to disable it just so we're sure that you finish all of these particular steps that are following, because you can't, if you get sidetracked while you're doing it and what have you, we need to make sure that, once you assign yourself to the super user role, or something like that, you will still have access to it. So in other words, if you go and start changing things, if it's already enabled and you start changing some of the security controls, you could end up locking yourself out. So it's good to just, if you've got it enabled, the first question to ask is, was that done on purpose, right? And then if it was, of course, you're already using role-based access control. So you got to be a little careful there. But, again, it's just important to disable it at least temporarily so we can go and make these changes to ensure that your user ID and any of these other administrators will keep their access. And you'll just see it's a simple, enable-disable checkbox under the Security Options tab again. Go on to slide 19. Second step. First thing you want to make sure of, and this is important too, is that the super user role, which is what we're going to use for the administrators, has all the permissions set to the highest setting. Give you the menu to get to. It's very straightforward to get to it. The from the roles tab, just double click the super user. Then from the super user Super User Role Permissions tab, verify the settings are all at the maximum, including delete wherever possible. Now, there is an alternative. If you're, again, the problem being, I don't know if specifically when the product was installed, if all of these were set to the highest for you or if it's been modified, but it is important to make sure you have all of the permissions set as according to this attachment. Now, the attachment is back at that link on the previous slide where I referenced that tech note. This is one way you can go and make sure that you do have the super user set for all of the access needed for the super user. go to slide 20. Now you're going to want to add your own user ID. You'd add them, assign them to the role of super user. Give you the steps here to go do that. From the user ID definitions tab, you know, you just simply click new. You enter your user ID again exactly as it is defined on the server. That is very important. And then in this case, we're not participating in access groups. Again, just remember access groups are for refining it to a subset of objects. Like, for example, a group of maps within all of your maps, you know, a set of trading partners within all of your trading partners. So that's a further refinement beyond what the role-based solution gives. Go to slide 21. Now, to assign your user ID to the super user, it's really easy. I mean, you just use the dialog here to select the super user role and then move it to the right on the selected role side. And you want to repeat step 3. It's on the previous slide, but just repeat step 3 to add any other user IDs as super users who require full access. I'm assuming you'll have more than one. And you need somebody to back you up, of course. So I would at least need two. Go to slide 22. As I was introduced before, was this the ampersand WDI user, the default predefined user ID. Make sure that this, you know, if you're going with this solution, right, this is going to cover now all of the other users besides the administrators, right? So all of the users that you just want them to be able to look at everything but not change anything. That's what this special default user ID is going to do. And just make sure that it has no roles and no permissions are defined to it. If there are any specified, you know, remove them. Again, the key part of this being this WDS user. Now, again, you don't have to limit it to read-only for the solution you do, but just as a general term, I want to emphasize that it's just meant to be for all of the users, you know, that are not explicitly defined to the client. And just to kind of emphasize again here, you know, you might be thinking, well, I don't want just anybody to be able to get in, you know, anybody from the company even to view, right? But just realize there are still the underlying DB2 permissions, which are still enforced. So, I mean, in other words, this does not supersede or take precedence or override the underlying DB2 permission. So if there is a user that you really do not want to have access to it, it really comes down to whether or not they were given access via the grant statements, which we're going to talk about coming up. Go to slide 23. Now that we've defined the users to the system, we can now just enable role-based access. Going to give you the path for the menus, and simply just check the box to enable role-based access control. Now, I'll kind of discuss, you'll see that the checkbox is underneath here. I'll tell you a little bit about these. Yeah, allow perform import using WDI client, allow perform export, allow perform delete using WDI client. Those three options are not about using WDI client to do the import or the export or the delete, but from using that remote submissions I had talked about, where if you, you know, from the client, can I execute these perform commands? And that last option allows the WDI server to export and import roles, user IDs, and access groups. This is only, you know, if you would be managing, you know, security in batch. And again, I haven't seen that used, but again, if you were interested in trying to move, you know, or maybe from test to production, for example, or something like that, you know, that might be something you want to use. And again, just want to emphasize that these checkboxes below the enabling checkbox are not for the WDI client import functions. You know, that is the function from, like, the file menu. Go to slide 24. Sixth step is to just to save the options that we just set previously, and then just restart your client. Then step seven, which is the last step, and very important step, though. I was talking about how the DB2 grant statements really are the underlying control mechanism for authorization to the tables, whether it be through WDI client or through any other tool, DB2 tool, you know, what have you. That is controlled by the grant permissions that are assigned. And, you know, even if you had, you know, assigned a particular user to a role, for example, and they don't have the needed underlying, you know, database grants for the tables and views for that particular object type, you know, it's the WDI client will try to go and do it because you said that's what their role is, you know, based on the setup for the security. So it's going to, it's a matter of what it's allowing WDI client to try to do. So then it let's say if they don't have the grants for the underlying tables for the object, then it's going to fail with a database error instead, right? And that's kind of the whole point of assigning these roles is so it brings up the list as appropriate. It brings up the object itself for update if they have it. You know, it's all about what will WDI client attempt to do. And B2 grants are the all-important security mechanism for really locking down your system. Go to slide 25. I give you some paths here from the installation materials. These are where the grant statements would be, and it's all inclusive. So you'd have the Windows installation path. You know, I just give it to you there in case you don't know where that is. And you've got the AIX installation path. And for ZOS, it's just a partition data set and a member. Go to slide 26. I think maybe obvious, but I better say it. The administrators that you've defined will require full authority as provided for the tables and views within these grant statements. Simply would change, you know, again, some of it's not totally consistent in the provided grant statements, but sometimes it uses public, sometimes it's user 0, 1, or 2. You know, just kind of, but you just need to change public or the user with the number to the specific ID of the administrator, for example. And in this case, you know, when they are the administrator, they're obviously going to need the full-blown select, update, you know, et cetera, you know, grants as they're provided in these members. And for the non-administrator IDs, it takes a little more customizing because, you know, now you want to pick, this is where you're really still going to need to assign the grant statements to limit their access. I mean, in other words, you don't want to give everybody else, you know, that you're trying to restrict to view only. You don't want to give them update, you know, authority, for example. You just simply copy the grant statements as provided and just change it so there's only select, which is also known as read authority. There's also, you change the public and user 0x to specify the particular user IDs, you know, that you want to work with. And just by, you know, realize if you haven't granted public, you know, if you have only, up to this point, only been granting, you know, down to specific user IDs, then realize everybody else is locked out. I mean, only the ones that have been granted will be able to access the data. Okay. We're going to go on to slide 27 and shift gears. That's it for the example for the role-based access control. Now we're going to get into the change control feature of WDI client. I thought this was appropriate. We've been getting some more questions on this as of late as well. Just wanted to make sure you're all aware of this function, and it is a useful function. Now I get the question quite frequently, where, you know, how can I tell who changed this map? How can I tell who did this? And it's all you have without this feature. All you have is one date timestamp of the last user who updated it. So you can't tell who updated it in between the last time, you know, et cetera. So this is the audit trail is the feature that will let you keep track of each and every update. And it is optional, of course. It is a matter of just checking. You know, I'm going to checkbox, I mean. Once it's enabled, though, it will keep an audit trail of all changeable database objects. Entry is created for any configuration change event. So it is also specific, like for your system. In other words, you're going to have two different databases, one for test, one for production. I mean, one can be enabled, the other can be disabled. There's also support for the configuration database. Talking about before, that's again just for the preferences, et cetera, not so useful. I mean, again, we're talking the runtime, the system databases, that's your DB2 side, that's the important one. It does apply to all users, so it's not like you can have an explicit user defined and they do not participate once it's enabled. Nope, they all participate. Go on to slide 28. It does, you know, give you some more details behind what it looks like. It records the user ID and timestamp for each change, not just the last updated date and time. Records the action that was taken, whether it was a create, an update, or compiling a map, etc. There is also support for server import functions, so that will track in your audit trail as well. On to slide 29. Continuing with the audit trail feature, to enable it, like I said, it's easy to do. Just to give you the menu path there. You can see just the checkbox there at the top, enable audit trail. Now, I happen to have the radio button selected here to require the user to enter a description of the change. You don't have to do that, or you can make it optional, as you can see on those other two radio buttons. Optionally include release migration, which that would be if you're migrating from a previous release to 3.3. I don't think you'd be doing that in this case. 3.2 has been out of support for some time, so I don't know if that's going to be very, very useful for you or not. Then again, there's the import documents, each object imported, and the WDI server that writes to the audit trail. You can kind of play around with those to see if you, you can check all of these. You're going to get more verbose, data as you do that. So just be aware that you're going to be using more space and such. But again, if you need to lock that down or see the change control, then you would want to enable all of those checkboxes. I'll talk about that last one that's grayed out there at the bottom of the screen coming up. Go to slide 30. This feature, the audit trail feature, does not keep track of the old and new values. So it's not going to be real explicit and say, this was changed, this one field and this, like it's a trading partner, which there's hundreds of fields associated with it. It's not going to say this particular field was edited and this is what it was and this is what it was changed to. But you can force the user to enter a description of the change. The dialog box that shows that. And the audit trail cannot be used to restore deleted objects or updated objects. In other words, you can't take this, all of these entries that have been performed for a certain period of time and then just go backwards. That's not doable. This is only just recording what was done. It's not allowed or doesn't give you the ability to restore. Moving on to slide 31. Here I'm showing you just how to query the audit trail log. It's from the view menu. Just click audit trail and it brings up a dialog to specify your selection if you want to narrow your search to a date and time, for example. Type of object. And I give you a quick snippet, a screenshot there of a couple of, I did a trading partner profile called sample partner. The action was update. Shows my user ID, then the date and time. And then the description is what I put into the dialog box on the previous slide. And I just show another example of a map, data transformation map. It's just a sample map that we provide with the product. And, you know, and I just compiled it, and then this is the record that it shows. Again, the description is going to be up to the user. That's not coming from WDI programmatically. All of the other stuff is to the left of the description, but the description itself will only, you know, will be exactly what was put in by the user when the change was made. Go to slide 32. Just give you the table name of the particular for the audit trail function. If it's just EDI audit HDR, and that table is the only table that will contain all of these rows, you know, associated with the particular changes made by users over time. I had talked about before on that previous slide where purge old audit trail entries. This option is only available for the local Windows database. Like, for example, this WDI client 33dev.mdb. Now, that Windows or standalone database, you know, don't confuse it with the configuration DB. This is the, you know, kind of the as-shipped standalone not connecting to DB2 database, you know, that is provided with WDI client when you originally install it. So this purge old audit trail entries, while nice, it does not pertain to the system or the DB2 side of things. So if you do have, you know, which of course in all of our cases, right, the WDI system is connecting to DB2, you know, and so on for this, so you will have to plan to do periodic maintenance to keep this table from filling up. Now again, if it's not enabled, of course you don't need to do this, but when you enable it, you're going to need to plan for keeping it cleaned out, otherwise it will just fill up. All right, let's go to slide 33, just kind of summarize here. Gone over the WDI client and the security features therein. Hopefully you can now work towards securing the system a little better according to your needs. You can use roles then to control users who perform similar tasks, so they're grouped together. So you don't have to do every user ID individually, you know, with specific permissions. A role can have all of the permissions assigned to it, and then those users performing similar tasks then are assigned to the role. And I've introduced you to the use of access groups. And this is just to refine any given object type to a group of objects. The group being the, you know, like for example, again, you have a set of, you've got all of your maps, and maybe only map A, B, and C. You want to have, you know, limited access by an access group. So it just takes it that one step further. Hopefully, you can now plan your security implementation. You can either start with the example given to kind of get you started, and I think it will make it a lot easier then for you to start using roles more effectively, or if you need to. And again, a lot of this depends on how many users do you have, how many are really running the EDI client. And I think the more you have, the more you need to plan this. In other words, that's where you're really going to take advantage of all the various roles and limit what each of those particular groups of people can access. And lastly, been introduced to the WDI audit trail feature. Hopefully you'll take advantage of that. So you don't call and ask if I can tell you what was changed and when. This feature hopefully will get you a little better control of your changes. Yeah, let's go to slide 34. I'm going to quickly cover some additional WebSphere resources. This is mainly for the overall WebSphere brand of products. You can learn about WebSphere Support Technical Exchange webcasts. That's what we're on now. You can see upcoming ones and access the previously recorded presentations. You can follow or discover the latest trends in WebSphere technology, briefings, webcasts, and podcasts. You can join the global WebSphere community. Also access key product show me demos and tutorials. By visiting the IBM Education Assistant. There's also a webcast replay for step-by-step instructions for using the Service Request or SR tool. This is the online or electronic tool that you use to open problem records. This is becoming more and more important for submitting problems and for managing them. It is a tool that does offer features that really do speed up the support process rather than it always being by phone. And last but not least, you can sign up for weekly technical My Notification emails. I don't think this is used enough. I try to tell customers about it when I do discuss problems with them, but it's a great way to stay informed as we publish new information about a set of products or just WDI. I mean, you can be selective for everything WebSphere, which is probably too much, or you can be very specific to just get notified about WDI itself or other products as you need. And that concludes the presentation, so back over to you, David.
Thank you, John, for a great presentation. Don't forget to connect with us. You can be notified about upcoming webcasts related to the product and topics discussed today by subscribing to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange mailing list. Simply send an email to wsehelp@us.ibm.com with subject WSTE subscribe. Also, if there is a topic you would like to see scheduled or if you have any comments that would help us improve our future webcasts, please let us know at that same email address. You could also connect with us through our Facebook page and our Twitter account. Talk to us and let us know how we can make this program better. Thanks again for your participation. Moving on to the Q&A session, I would like to remind you that for those of you who joined us via the web conference, you can also post your questions in the group chat. Precedence will be given to questions asked through the phone, and if time permits, we will also address questions in the group chat. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site by early next week. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, John, for presenting today.
Thank you, everyone.
This does conclude today's conference call. Thank you for your participation.